then we can get started. So today, the focus of today's lecture is going to be about memory and attention. And first I'll recap a little bit of what I said yesterday, and then to show you where memory and attention fit within usage-based linguistics. And I'll give you a bit of a background on what has been done on the topics of memory and attention in combination with language. And that's then a preparation for tomorrow's lecture on construal. So just so that you know where we are in the larger scheme of things. So yesterday I talked at length about usage-based linguistics and how usage-based theories of language start from the assumption that it is possible for language users to build a grammar from the ground up by being exposed to language, and they do so by using domain general cognitive abilities. So different from what generative linguists would assume, cognitive linguists or usage-based linguists don't see any need for an innate language-specific cognitive module. Language is learned through exposure. That also means that the grammar or the structure or the knowledge of language that language users build up remains rather concrete and very faithful to the experience. So we don't rely on very formalized notation methods to capture what we think language users extract from exposure to language. Of course, as I also explained yesterday, things aren't always as straightforward. And if you are a cognitive linguist, then you may feel torn between highlighting or focusing on the cognitive or versus focusing on the linguistic. And these two things aren't always the same or don't give the same result. Because if you focus on the cognitive, you would be favoring a psychologically realistic representation or description. Whereas if you focus on the linguistic, you would favor or prioritize descriptive accuracy. And the way those two approaches don't necessarily lead to the same result. Now, as I mentioned yesterday, there is one commitment that unites cognitive linguists, or well, we could see it that way, because it goes back to a programmatic statement by Lakoff in 1990. It's called the cognitive commitment, which prioritizes cognitive reality, so to speak. Because on his approach to cognitive linguistics, all cognitive linguists are committed to providing a characterization or description of the general principles that govern all aspects of human language. And that description is supposed to be informed by and in accordance with what we know about the brain and the mind from other disciplines. So if there's discrepancy between the linguistically or descriptively accurate and the cognitively realistic, in a sense, we should give priority to the cognitively, psychologically realistic because of our cognitive or our commitment to cognitive reality. And I also said yesterday that within usage-based linguistics, languages are seen as dynamic systems that are shaped by usage. As I said, we consider that this is done through the use of general cognitive abilities and the typical ones that you will encounter as soon as you open any handbook on cognitive linguistics or introductions to cognitive linguistics. You will see mention of things like classification, generalization and abstraction, imagination, which is treated through metaphor and metonymy. There is also some reference to what we would call cognitive constructs, such as memory, for example, and attention. But these have received some attention, but not as much as I think they should have received, or as much attention as would have been expected. Memory, for example, isn't widely discussed within cognitive and linguistic approaches to language, even though frequency plays a crucial role in usage-based approaches, and frequency effects are, in essence, memory effects. A similar thing can be said for attention, which also plays a crucial role in language and has had some attention within usage-based linguistics, but it's remained rather marginal. So this lecture is going to be about memory and attention and the role that they play putting them more clearly on the scene or on the radar of usage-based linguists. And much of what I will be talking about, if you want to know more about the things that I will be mentioning, I will refer you to my book, which Professor Lee also mentioned yesterday. It's called Frequency in Language, Memory, Attention, and Learning, and appeared in late 2019 with Cambridge University Press. So you have the link to the book on the slide. So if you want to know more about memory, more about attention, how it links to frequency and the role it plays within usage-based linguistics, then I would invite you to read the book and by all means, let me know what you think of it. So I'll split up this lecture in two parts. One is going to be about frequency and entrenchment, which are concepts that are linked to memory. And then towards the end of the lecture, I'll move to talking about attention. I'll start a discussion about attention, but as I said, tomorrow we will be presenting an extensive case study that invokes many concepts of attention. So we will continue the discussion of attention in tomorrow's lecture as well. Now, what is memory, right? Memory is something we cannot observe, but it plays a very prominent role in our lives. And memory is generally defined as our ability to make what is learned persist through time. And that's, of course, in and of itself already quite a complex definition that introduces lots of other terms that would need to be explored further. One term that immediately captures the attention is that it has to do with what is learned. And as I mentioned yesterday, learning is not something that usage-based linguists have paid much attention to. And the other difficult thing is, of course, time, which is another unobservable property that has fascinated philosophers and linguists and cognitive scientists for many centuries. Memory has indeed quite a few, or the concept of memory, the construct of memory, has in a few things in common with time. Both are invisible. And interestingly, as you as cognitive linguists will know, metaphors have been very prominent in the way in which human beings have conceptualized time. And this is exactly the same for memory. And while I was writing my book, I actually found this one of the most interesting aspects that I actually learned while I was working on the book. Until I started reading up on the metaphors that have been used to aid the conceptualization of memory, I wasn't really aware of the fact, as is typical with metaphors, of course, that they had been used, and that much of research on memory depends so strongly on the metaphor that is in vogue at the time the research is conducted. And of course, metaphors help you see and help you understand things, but they also phrase things or frame things in a very specific way. And what seems to have happened with metaphors for memory is that the metaphors that have been very, very prominent are metaphors of storage and retrieval. So where can I put things so that I can find it later? And then that's the storage bit, right? You put something somewhere for use later on. And then retrieval is how can I find the things that I have put away for later usage? And because these metaphors have been so prominent, the way in which researchers have approached memory and have designed ways to investigate memory, to understand memory, have also been very much in this tradition. And there's a really interesting book that traces the different metaphors that have been used to approach the study of memory over the past 2000 years. And it's really interesting to see how those metaphors closely follow the technological development. So initially you had clay tablets and writing implements that were used at the time. And at the time people thought of memory as leaving an imprint somewhere, which was closely related to the technology they had available at the time to write things down. And then, of course, with the technological developments and the advent of the computer, much of the computer itself has become a metaphor for memory. And as you know, computers have hard drives on which you store information in folder structures with all kinds of different files, and then you can go and retrieve this information from specific paths, et cetera, et cetera. And this whole metaphor of the computer has also left its mark on how memory has been studied and approached. Of course, over the past few years, researchers have moved away from this kinds of metaphors, and you will know that the metaphor that currently dominates research is that of a network. But as with all metaphors, you know, it's really important to be aware of the power they have and the way they can influence the way you think about things without you even being aware of this. So I think if you're a cognitive linguist, you will really find this literature very interesting. So in line with this storage and retrieval metaphor for memory, the most generally accepted presentation or approach to memory is that there would be three types of memory. There's something that's called the sensory registered, then there's something that's called short-term or working memory, and then there's something that's called long-term memory. And they each store things in different ways and for different amounts of time, so to speak. So in the sensory register, in that process, the brain basically obtains information from the environment. So this activity is very short. That type of memory lasts only a few seconds. And during this time, the brain collects information passively, either through visual or through auditory cues. And this is known respectively as iconic and echoic memory. So for example, when you look at, you're now currently looking at this lecture, you're seeing my slides. When you close your eyes, you can still see the image you saw on the screen for a few seconds, and that's iconic memory at play. Or now that you're listening to this presentation, if I would ask you to repeat what I just said, you would probably be able to repeat the last few words you heard. So that's echoic or auditory memory at play. And we will get back to this again in the attention part of this lecture, there is so much going on visually and auditorily that it is not really possible for you to retain everything on a millisecond by millisecond basis. And then in the memory making process, attention is considered a stage between sensory registration and short-term memory. So it's generally thought that short-term memory formation can only begin because you give your or you pay specific attention to some of the information that you've received through your visual or auditory registration, so to speak. And then this short-term memory or working memory are two names, two labels we use for memory that is active longer than a few seconds, but shorter than a few hours or days, for example. So short-term memory used to be the cover term, but it's now generally accepted that it consists of two different things. So short-term memory is memory where the brain stores information temporarily so that it can be repeated, like you are trying to remember your friend's phone number, for example. And working memory then is a different dimension of this construct, and that refers to the brain storing information or making information available for the purpose of manipulating it. So instead of when you get a phone number, you try to memorize it exactly the way it is, but when you're giving the same digits as part of a maths problem, you will have to manipulate them to be able to get to the solution. So those are two different dimensions of the same shorter term memory that we assume exists, because that's basically the case with a lot of the memory, a lot of the research on memory and attention. These things are constructs, and I remember being shocked when I found out that maybe there is no such thing as memory or as attention. These are constructs, these are ways in which we think about processes that go on in our minds and in our brains. So after we've registered sensorially information and have moved that to our short-term or working memory where we can store it for a short while or manipulate it to do other things with it, there is something that's called long-term memory. And the typical way of thinking of long-term memory is kind of like a bank, a storage facility within the brain. Once a memory arrives here, you know, through sensory registration and after passing through a short-term memory, then the mind stores it in long-term memory completely and probably indefinitely, although there's discussion about this as well, whether memories are stored indefinitely and any retrieval problems have to do with problems of access or whether memory traces actually decay and memories might disappear over time. Because it's, you know, it's unclear whether memories that are stored in this long-term storage facility, it's not necessarily the case that they are that they're free or safe against being removed or deleted. But it is indeed possible that memories that are stored in this long-term storage facility, it is possible for them to stay in the brain as long as your lifetime. So this is the general picture of memory as consisting of three different subcomponents that each store information for a different length of time, so to speak, from very short in the sensory register to possibly a lifetime in long-term memory. But yeah, bear in mind that this is how we think about memory. This is very different from being able to say this is exactly how it works. There are very many different and opposing opinions within research on memory as there are within research on linguistics. So what is important for linguists, or what linguists have paid more attention to, is the strength of the memories that you store. And the strength of the memories that you store are said to be a function of frequency of exposure. And that's the bit that linguistics has really been keen on to explore. But there are also aspects of the encoding procedure that are important. And that's actually the way in which you have learned the information that you then store in memory. In this lecture, I will talk about frequency of exposure and how that's played a role within usage-based linguistics. But of course, the learning is very important for the approach we are taking with the Out of Our Minds team. And Petter will tell you more about learning and the basics of learning theory in the Thursday lecture. So why has frequency been so appealing to usage-based linguists? Well, the simple reason is that frequency is among the most robust predictors of human performance. And it was noted sometime in the 50s last century that with practice, behavioral sequences become faster and less prone to error. So the more often you do something, the more fluently you can perform this action and the less likely you are to make an error. And you know, you can come up with lots of examples in your life where this is the case, like from tying your shoelaces to riding a bike to driving a car. It's all very difficult in the beginning. The more you do it, the easier it becomes for you, the less likely you are to make an error. So that's a process of automatization as well. Now you may wonder, okay, with practice, behavioral sequences become faster and less prone to error, but do we really think of language as a behavior? And is language a memory? Initially, I have to say, I thought it was strange to think of language as a memory. For me, memories are things like, I remember when I was a child and I went to the beach, or remember when I was a child and had an ice cream, or I remember going on vacation here or there, but I never thought of language as a memory. And I never thought of things like the English past tense marker ED as a memory, or maybe case marking in Russian, that the endings for all the different cases would be memories. I thought this was a very strange approach, but these things are memories too. And this is why the same effects of frequency play a role in language knowledge as well. And the research with this, or the fascination with frequency, really started with research into words, so words in isolation, so to speak. And psychologists, psycholinguists who were doing this type of research in the lab were noticing that when they exposed participants to low frequency words versus high frequency words, they noticed that high frequency words were recognized faster. They were recalled more easily, they were accessed more easily, and they were, all of this was done with less error than low frequency words. So they concluded that if this is the case, if given what we are seeing, word processing must be experience driven. And that, of course, opened the door to thinking that maybe language processing more generally would be experience driven. And for that to be the case, we had to show that language processing more generally was sensitive to the frequency with which elements occurred. Because in the end, frequency of occurrence is just a proxy for repetition of experience. And if we can show that the surface distributions of elements in language contain the necessary information to build up the mental linguistic representations that we appear to be seeing, we would be able to make a case for a usage-based linguistics. So going against generative linguistics. So within the generative school, these types are not a consequence of token repetition, but the types exist in universal grammar and they manifest themselves as tokens in language use. So the generative understanding of the type token relationship is top down. And the token frequencies that you see in language are not permitted to change the grammar. The grammar is governed by universal grammar. And therefore, token frequency is largely irrelevant to generative grammars of language, except in a few exceptional circumstances. So generative linguists consider frequency as a performance factor. It doesn't change the grammar, which is governed by universal grammar. The only parts of the system where frequency has an effect have to do with the lexicon, which they considered something ruleless anyway, and in what they call parameter settings. So the specific settings of your language might have something to do with frequency of occurrence, but not the general principles. Usage-based linguists, on the other hand, assume the exact opposite. So they assume that linguistic experience, so the actual occurrence of your tokens in your experience, shapes your mental linguistic representations, and the frequency with which things occur is just a proxy for the experience that you have had. So it might be very difficult to quantify your experience, but if you can go into a collection of text and count how many times something has occurred, then you have a reasonable proxy for your experience. And usage-based linguists would also go as far as to predict frequency effects for all linguistic units, simple units, complex units, lexical units, grammatical units. So all of the mental representations that we acknowledge in linguistics would be shaped by experience, and experience can be quantified by counting how often things occur. Oops, sorry, that was too fast. So when people started pursuing this research program, this was of course extremely exciting. And depending on the extent to which they could show the influence of frequency of occurrence on processing and the strength that that frequency would have on the occurrence, on processing, would weaken or strengthen or would yield a weaker or a stronger case for a dynamical model of language where linguistic structure is grounded in language use. If we could really show that frequency of occurrence applies to all types of items, simple, complex, lexical, grammatical, then that would give us a very strong case for a dynamical model of grammar where structure is grounded in use and go against the, at the time, dominant opinion adhered to by generative linguists, where competence is completely separate from performance. So knowledge of your linguistic structures is something completely different from how speakers use language and what factors influence comprehension and production. Now, the interesting thing is that human beings extract this frequency information automatically from their environment. So we don't need to be told that we need to track the past morpheme ed in English, for example, to be able to form the past tense. That's not how it goes. Even small children seem to be very, very aware of frequency, and this awareness is implicit, so to speak. They track this information automatically, and because it's something that happens automatically that you don't have to pay attention to, this avenue became even more promising, as Nick Ellis put it. Given the fact that human beings extract frequency information automatically from their environment, they really are in a position to use the statistical properties of the linguistic input they are exposed to discover structure. And that structure includes sound patterns, words, and the beginnings of grammar. So this ability to detect and extract the distributional characteristics of a natural language really played a key role in the development of usage-based linguistics as a linguistic theory, because this gave us a way to get around the need for these environmental triggers that the generativists relied on. And it changed the way in which we thought about language from being governed by a universal grammar that's innate and located in a specific component of our minds and brains, to something that we learn using general cognitive abilities. And what we learn is not a universal grammar, but a probabilistic grammar that's grounded in our individual language experience. So that goes straight against what Chomsky had been saying, and against the foundational assumptions of generative grammar. So this is why frequency and frequency of occurrence has played such a crucial role in usage-based linguistics, and why you see it crop up so often. It's the extent and the power of frequency of occurrence on language processing that allowed linguists to refute Chomsky's view that competence is separate from performance and that we need to rely on a universal innate grammar. Yeah, so it suggests that there might be a dynamic model of grammar in which structure is grounded in use. This remains controversial to this day. And I've put the reference here to a book by Ben Ambridge and Elena Leven, which I found really very interesting, because it contrasts the predictions of usage-based models of language with predictions made by generative models of language for child language acquisition. So child language acquisition has also been one of the main battlefields in which generative linguists and usage-based linguists have fought with each other, so to speak, over which theory would be more likely to be the right one. So if anyone's interested in this particular dispute, and if anyone's interested in child language acquisition, I strongly recommend the book by Ambridge and Leven. It's from 2011. But it's still very much irrelevant. So frequency of occurrence is crucial in usage-based linguistics. It's a foundational topic in cognitive linguistics, and it's also included as a chapter in our Handbook of Cognitive Linguistics, which I edited with Eva Dombrowska, and it appeared in 2015 as one volume. It's now available as a set of three paperbacks as well. In that handbook, frequency and entrenchment is a separate chapter listed among the foundational topics, but frequency of occurrence is not typically a topic that you find in a general intro to linguistics. So I think it is probably for us as well interesting to go and look a bit further into the origin of the two terms, frequency and entrenchment, and how they relate to each other. And that's the chapter that I wrote together with Catherine Caldwell Harris from the University of Boston, that's included in this handbook of cognitive linguistics. And this was another really interesting thing to work on, because I'm a linguist, Catherine's a psychologist, and we came to the same topic with very different assumptions that were then, you know, contrasted with what we actually found in the literature. And we also found out that we both thought the wrong thing about frequency and entrenchment. So frequency is a very intuitive term. As I said, it refers to how often a stimulus, such as a word or a phrase or a construction, occurs in the environment. And it's a term that originated in experimental psychology. Because in psychology, psychologists were interested in studying particular things, particular words, and they didn't want to have, they typically don't want to have any confounds in their experiments. So they control for a large number of properties of the stimuli that they use. And for words, they started controlling for frequency of occurrence, because they'd found previously that, as I said before, frequent items are responded to in a different way than low frequent items. And entrenchment is a term that really sits within the literature on memory, but the term entrenchment as such was introduced as a theoretical construct within cognitive linguistics by Laniker in his 1987 book, where he tries to explain how linguistic structures are created and shaped through use. If you look for entrenchment in the memory literature, you're not going to find a single reference. At least I have not been able to. So this is a bit of a contradictory situation, where you would think frequency occurrence and how often elements are used in language. I was expecting this to have an origin within linguistics, and entrenchment to originate in the memory literature, so in psychology, but what we found was actually the exact opposite. So first I'll talk to you about frequency of occurrence, and that will then lead to a discussion of entrenchment. And as I said, frequency of occurrence is an idea from psycholinguistics, but it's also been, especially the way in which it's been used in linguistics, has been heavily influenced by corpus linguistics, which we discussed yesterday, which is by cognitive linguists used as a methodology, and we have borrowed many of their measures. So, as I mentioned before, psycholinguists were interested in how, or are interested in how humans process language. And they found that frequency or higher frequency leads to a speedy response time in laboratory tasks. So they started controlling for these things. But of course, if you work with, if you've worked with psychologists, you will know that they really like to dig in things and try to experiment with things. So they started looking into what frequency of occurrence itself correlates with. And they found that a word is not just highly frequent or low frequent. A word is high frequent and a number of other things. So the frequency with which a word occurs is strongly correlated with other characteristics of the word. And some of the correlates of frequency that you will encounter when you look through the literature is that high frequent words are also short in length. They tend to be concrete. They tend to be easily imaginable. They tend to be acquired early on in life. They also have higher orthographic neighborhood density, so lots of other words look like them. They have a larger syntactic family size. They have an increased noun-verb ratio. They have a higher number of different meanings, so they're more polysemous, et cetera, et cetera. And so Catherine, the colleague I worked with on the chapter, had done an interesting study where she compared lexical processing across occupations. Because of course, once you start looking at frequency, and then you realize that all of these highly frequent words also have other properties, it becomes difficult to ascribe any part of the frequency effect to frequency itself, because all of these other properties are always in play as well. And what she did was she compared secular Jews and religious Jews on their knowledge of the texts from the Torah, and the texts that were set in their religious gatherings. And she found that the religious Jews were actually better and faster at recognizing those specific words than the non-religious Jews were. So she took that as support for the idea that at least part of the word frequency effect is due to the language user's actual experience with the word, because of course these words were the same in frequency, the same in length, in imagability, in age of acquisition, but the religious Jews encountered them much more frequently than the secular Jews, and that's why they had an advance in responding to those words. So there is some effect. There is something to the frequency effect that is due to frequency alone and due to your individual exposure to the word in question alone. But when psychologists started digging deeper, they also found that, you know, very often when you look at psychological experiments, words are presented in isolation. So you have a screen, you present one word, and you ask the respondents or your participants to click a button if the word, the left button if the word's not real, the right button if the word's real, for example. But of course, we don't really encounter words in isolation. And this is something that linguists and corpus linguists in particular have always been aware of, but it hasn't been so prominent in psycholinguistic research. Of course, when you do an experiment, you want to control as much as possible. And the less you provide your participants with, the less there is that can confound your results. So there's the choice, the option to go for individual words in psycholinguistic research is justifiable, but of course it's not quite ecologically valid because people don't encounter words in isolation. So once psychologists started taking the context into account, they started finding that the context in which the word occurs, especially the semantic properties of the context, might be the real factors that lead to faster processing. And they started looking at things that they called contextual and semantic diversity. So since lexical learning is contextual in nature, as we linguists would agree with, what they started doing to capture this context is they started counting the number of different documents in which a word occurred. So if you know a corpus contains maybe 1,000 texts written by different authors, so they then started counting the number of different documents, different texts in which that word occurred. And then they defined the similarity between pairs of documents as a function of the proportion of overlapping words in the document. So two documents are very similar if very many words occur across both documents, and two documents are not so similar if they don't have many words in common. And I think all linguists in the audience will now be thinking, well, that's a very crude way of defining or operationalizing context. But even this very crude way showed that the number of different contexts in which a word occurs is psychologically more relevant than the frequency with which a word occurred. So I think as linguists, we can do, of course, even better than that. But even this very crude way of operationalizing context showed that context is actually very important. And then they went one step further and they said, well, in addition to context, semantic distinctiveness is even more important. So what we really should be looking at is not frequency of occurrence, not frequency within similar or dissimilar documents, but repetitions with a change in meaning. And then they did another crude approach. So they calculated the semantic diversity as the mean dissimilarity over all documents in which the words occurred. And this explains or predicted even more variance in response time than word frequency and contextual distinctiveness. Of course, we linguists would again say this is a very crude way of doing things, but again, it shows that even this crude way in which we can take context into account shows that context is actually really very important. And I think this is where corpus linguistics comes in and has something to offer to linguists who are interested in frequency. And when you go over the literature, you see that there are basically five types of measures to calculate word frequency, word co-occurrence, and usage of words in context in different ways. So there are five types of measures that have been used in cognitive corpus linguistics. I discuss them in a bit more detail in a paper I wrote in 2017, and that's linked here on the slide as well. And these five measures are either the raw frequencies, contextual frequencies, relative frequencies, tests or measures that rely on significance testing, such as colostructural strength, and then measures from information theory. And I will briefly explain in very simple terms what the first four are about, so that it becomes easier for you to imagine what's going on here. I'm also referring you to, there are five types, but there are many dozens of association measures. So there is an online repository that's been put together by Stefan Evert, where he discusses 27 association measures. Then there is a paper from 2008 where 47 versions of association measures are tested. And Natalia Levshina, in her 2015 Statistics for Linguists book, tested 66 versions of association measures. So there is endless variation. But in essence, all these measures can be reduced to five different types. So the first, the raw frequency one, is the easiest one. If we look at the sentence here, like, we are honored to be invited to present our research to Chinese scholars. What you do when you record raw frequency is you literally count how often each string occurs in your sentence. So we occurs once, are occurs once, honored occurs once, but then we have two that occurs three times, like to be invited, to present, and to Chinese scholars. So if you want nothing more than the raw frequency, this is what you get on the basis of this one sentence alone. If you want contextual frequency, which is what I think linguists would feel is more interesting, then you get a different count, so to speak. So if we look at the context in which the word present is used, then we can either look at the preceding context, we are invited to present, and that occurs once, or we can be asked to present our research, so present with a direct object, and that occurs also once. We have two different contexts in which present is used. You can say the raw frequency of present is one, but you can look before and after, so to speak, at the different contexts. And then when we look at relative frequencies, we have two options. Either you look at the word depending on what precedes or what follows. So again, in the same sentence, we are honored to be invited to present our research to Chinese scholars. If you look at how often to occurs, given that there is a verb that precedes, we find that two out of the three instances of to are used in such construction. But if you want to see how often to occurs given a preceding adjective, we find that there is one case. Or you can also turn things around and say, I want to know how often I encounter a verb after I've seen to, or how often I encounter an adjective after I've seen to, and then you can go and enter those counts. So you see that depending on how you phrase your question, or how you phrase what actually you're interested in, your counts will come out very differently, even though the sentence is still the same. So all of these measures give you slightly different results based on exactly the same data. So that's important for you to bear in mind when you look at research and frequency. What exactly have they counted and how have they done it? And then we have measures that also rely on significance testing, such as, for example, the suite of colostructural techniques that I think you will be familiar with. And there you're doing things like, if you're interested in honor two, then you will check how the frequency of honor two compares to the frequencies of honored and two individually, and their chance of co-occurring by chance. And then also how they compare, for example, to the frequency of research too. So again, you can do many different things, and depending on the question you ask, you will need to count different things and your results will come out differently as well. So this is a very, very brief overview of what raw frequency, contextual frequency, relative frequencies do, and measures with significance testing. So only in the measures with significance testing, you actually run a statistical test to see how likely your results are, or whether your results could be due to chance. Are these words co-occurring more often than pure chance, than luck would have it, so to speak? And if they do occur more often, you can say you're looking at a unit, at a chunk, things like that. So if you want to know more about that, I'd refer you to the 2017 paper where I go into a bit more detail about each of these types and what they mean for a cognitive linguistic analysis. So why am I talking about this? Because what is crucial for us is that frequency influences usage, because if frequency of occurrence in exposure can influence usage and structure, then we are in a situation where we could say actually usage is the thing that can shape grammar from the bottom up. We don't need anything top down, innate, available at birth. We can learn things using general cognitive mechanisms by being exposed to language alone. The question, of course, is how do we count? There are many different ways of counting things. The measures that have been used in psychology will be considered very crude by a linguist. Linguists themselves have borrowed lots of measures from corpus linguistics. Of course, corpus linguists aren't necessarily worried about cognitive reality. So all of these measures have their drawbacks when it comes to doing cognitively realistic research. And in the lectures that will come, we will introduce you to an algorithm that learns from the data in the way humans do, and that can also therefore count things that are relevant or should be relevant to real speakers of the language. So I think here we can take a break. Fine. So after talking about frequency, we will now talk a little bit about entrenchment, which is the result in the memory result of frequency, so to speak. And entrenchment is a term that was introduced by Lanneker into the literature. So as I said before, memory strength is a function of frequency of exposure, but also incorporates or is dependent on aspects of learning. And here we're talking about frequency effects just for a moment in isolation. And the reason why, the meaning that has been given to the frequency effect is the following. So why would memory have something like a frequency effect? And so memory shows that frequency effects are basically the fact that repeated exposure to an item strengthens its representation in memory. So the more frequently you have encountered something, done something, the more entrenched it would be in your memory. And then, of course, there are effects of encoding, of learning. So if the encounters with the item are separated in time and space, overall, that will give you a better strength memory trace. And this has been interpreted within something that's called the rational analysis of memory, that has proposed that it would be evolutionarily beneficial, it would be adaptive to encode into long-term memory those stimuli which are likely to occur often and which are likely to recur, so to speak. So for example, it's beneficially, I mean, in terms of survival, it's beneficial for you that you remember, for example, what a lion looks like if there are plenty of lions in your environment. It's best for you to recognize the lion, to know that it means danger so that you can go and hide. If you would forget what the lion looks like because you encounter them so infrequently, if you would forget what a lion looks like, even though you encounter it frequently, your chances of survival would not be very good. So this is a kind of a rational analysis. It's adaptive. It's been said that it's adaptive to encode those things in memory that you encounter frequently and that occur with relative frequency, so to speak, that happen over and over again. So and that's because on this theory, this so-called rational analysis of memory, memory has been seen as a tool to guide future actions. So you encode what is likely to reoccur in your environment, and you encode it with a strength that's proportional to the probability of this thing, you encountering this item or this thing again in the future. So if lions are frequent, lions are dangerous, it's very important for you to have a good memory trace of what a lion looks like so that you can recognize it and go and hide. Whereas other items or other items in your environment might not occur so frequently, might not have such an importance or present such a danger. And this would also be why a greater diversity of environments in which you have encountered something in the past would encourage you to encode something with a higher strength, because those things are probable to reoccur in the future. So if you encounter something only in one very specific context, it's limited, so to speak. The effect it can have, the danger it can you to do, is limited to a very specific context. If there is something that you encounter across all contexts, across all areas or aspects of your life, it's more important for you to encode these things more strongly in memory. So, and that would be why it's not only the frequency with which you encounter an item, but the many diverse contexts in which you encounter an item would be important. And that's how context has become important in the research on frequency within psychology, something that linguists would definitely agree with and would be supportive of. So this whole view of the brain as relying on memory-based predictions is an approach to memory and brain that's been gaining in popularity over the past few decades. So the brain is now thought of as extracting repeating patterns from the environment, storing them in memory, and using those to make predictions about the future. So, and this would be adaptive, this would have an evolutionary advantage, because the better we can predict what's going to happen next, the greater our chances of survival. But we all know that prediction is never 100% accurate. And there are some performance improvers, so to speak. There are properties of the body of information from which you derive your, of the experiences from which you derive your information that can improve your prediction, so to speak. So generally, it's been said that bigger is better. The more data you have access to, the better your predictions will be. But that's only if you have the know-how to use it in order to best predict the world. And this also applies to how we look at frequency in linguistics. So larger corpora are better, but only if you can extract information and count information in a way that actually maps onto how the human brain and mind would do so. And another thing to bear in mind is that accurate is not the same as veridical. So accurate predictions don't seem to require veridical representations in memory. So it seems to be sufficient for us to extract the gist of what we are experiencing rather than the detail and all of the, then to represent everything in minute detail, because doing so would overload our brain. So that's something that we need to be aware of too when we use frequency to do linguistic analysis. Like, how much information do we want to encode? How much information do we want to track? Because human brains don't necessarily track every single detail either. There's evidence to show that actually extracting a gist would be the better way to go. So as I said, entrenchment is a concept that was introduced by Lanneker in 1987 to explain how linguistic structure emerges from use. It's very frequently invoked in cognitive linguistic research, but when you go and look for a definition of the term, you find that the concept is not particularly well defined. So traditionally, it's assumed that frequency of occurrence affects entrenchment. So people don't remember all events, but they remember highly frequent information well. Repeated frequency or frequency of exposure provides language users with greater exposure. So more opportunities to experience the stimuli and more opportunities to process them mentally. That seems to be what we all agree on. So there's frequency of occurrence. The more frequently something occurs, the better remembered or the better entrenched that information would be. And that's because every time you encounter something, you process it, and that gives your brain the opportunity to strengthen the connections that support this memory. And when we look through the definitions in the works by some of the leading scholars who've used entrenchment, we see a difference in definition, so to speak. So when we look at what Laniker originally wrote, we see that he wrote there is a continuous scale of entrenchment in cognitive organization. Every use of a structure has a positive impact on its degree of entrenchment, whereas extended periods of disuse have a negative impact. So with repeated use, a novel structure becomes progressively entrenched to the point of becoming a unit. Moreover, units are variably entrenched depending on the frequency of their occurrence. So what he seems to be saying is that stimuli need to occur some number of times before they are unitized, and then they can grow in strength as a function of our experience with them. So that's a focus on representation, really. When we look at what Bybee wrote, we see that she adds processing into the mix. So she says, or she writes, that each token of use of a word or sequence of words strengthens its representation, like Laniker said, and makes it more easily accessed, which brings in the processing view. In addition, each instance of use further automates and increases the fluency of the sequence, leading to fusion of the units. You will remember that I said that on one of the very first slides, that the more often you do something, the easier you can do it, the faster you can do it, the fewer errors you make. And that's also the information that Bybee brings in here, where she says each instance of use automates and increases the fluency. And that leads then to fusion of units. So, she seems to be saying that these, you know, aspects of the neural networks that encode words in our brains and minds, they have become shaped via repeated exposure and learning so that the processing is more efficient. And then there is a younger colleague, Alice Blumenthal, who's done some neurolinguistic work looking into entrenchment from a usage-based perspective. And she seems to combine both Laniker's and Bybee's perspectives. So she says that higher token frequencies in usage will correlate with a gradual increase in ease of processing, more precisely in enhanced fluidity in composition or parsing. And at some point, this process will lead to a new holistic representation. After this point, facilitation, or more precisely ease of retrieval, will still continue to increase as a function of frequency. Now, as you will see, all three definitions refer to an increase in frequency or a decrease in frequency, but no one's really been very specific about how many instances or how many occurrences you need to have for this process to start taking place. And therefore, it's been said that, you know, this is the common view, the view that's commonly accepted within usage-based linguistics, but it lacks empirical support. Allegedly, people have been unable to find evidence of what might be a frequency threshold, and there has even been some logical discussion, you know, appealing to logic, to say that if a single exposure would be below an alleged threshold where counter begins accruing evidence, then the counter of exposure remains set to zero and logically no experience can accrue. And that has then led to a very negative assessment of our knowledge of frequency, or the knowledge, the appreciation of cognitive linguists for frequency. In Schmidt's 2010 paper, he writes, or he concludes by saying that so far we have understood neither the nature of frequency itself nor its relation to entrenchment, let alone come up with a convincing way of capturing either one of them or the relation between them in quantitative terms. So that was kind of the impetus for the paper that I published in 2017, where I looked at how we deal with items that are of low frequency. And it is true that prediction mechanisms cannot make reliable inferences without sufficient data. We also know that from statistical techniques. You need a minimum number of observations before you can run reliable statistics. But what I found is that at a very low frequency, it's not that there is no data, it's rather the case that there is not enough evidence to support a decision. And I found that even with extremely low frequent items, native speakers of a language find ways of dealing with them. It's just that because they have very, very little data, and possibly they each have been exposed to a very different subset of the data that is available, they take decisions that are not necessarily in agreement. The more data accumulates, the more people are exposed to a specific item, the more their judgments will agree. It's just at a very low frequency, and they don't have enough evidence to support a decision that they will all share, so to speak. So I will refer you to that paper for in more in-depth discussion if this is of interest to you. So to sum up this part, what I want you to take away is that if we want to work with frequency, and we should, because frequency is a crucial ingredient in usage-based theories, or in establishing usage-based theories of language as viable, we need measures that do what we need them to do. So we need measures to look at the element and the context in which the elements occur. We will also need measures that can track the element's frequency of occurrence in each context, ideally over time. And we, as linguists, we are not good with dealing with how things change over time, but only that will lead us to the entrenchment that we as linguists are after. And learning theory provides us with measures and algorithms that we can use for this. So I refer again to Thursday's lecture for an introduction to the different types of measures that we are using with the Out of Our Minds team. Okay, so in the last part of this talk, I will talk a little bit about the other concept, attention, and within linguistics, as frequency links to entrenchment in linguistics, attention links to salience in cognitive linguistics. I've said this a few times already. We have typically looked at cognitive abilities like classification, generalization, and imagination, but we have not so much looked at cognitive constructs such as memory, which is important for understanding frequency, and also not so much at looking, and we've also not looked so much as much as attention as we should have been. And as I mentioned when I was talking you through the three elements or dimensions of memory, and there is, our sensory organs can register or register too much information or more information than we can possibly process. So there is another construct, attention, that's called upon to regulate what goes from sensory perception into short-term memory. So experience is one thing, and as you know, typically we have auditory experiences and visual experiences. For language, this frequency with which things occur in our experience have been very important. And then somehow what we experienced ends up in our memory. But of course, not everything that we experience ends up in memory, partly because there is so much, we cannot process it. And also the other way around, if we store all of that, we would never be able to retrieve anything. So the role that attention plays between experience and actual memory is really very important, and one that we should be paying more attention to as well. Now, the problem is that attention is something that's very difficult to define. I would nearly say that attention is the unicorn of psychology. There's a lot of talk about attention, but it isn't necessarily very coherent. When you look through, for example, the Oxford Handbook of Attention, it's a 1500-page volume on attention in which you cannot find a single agreed-upon definition of attention. So generally, when people write about attention and try to define what attention is, they go back to the writing by William James from 1890, who defines what attention is and starts by saying, everyone knows what attention is. And then he says, it is the taking possession by the mind in clear and vivid form of one out of what seems several simultaneous possible objects or trains of thought. Focalization, concentration of consciousness are of its essence. It implies withdrawal from some things in order to effectively deal with others. And this is what the researchers of attention still go back to. I think it would sit beautifully in any cognitive linguistic work. It would fit, no problem at all. It's still not very precise. It's, you kind of know what attention is, but it's very difficult to put your finger on. It's very difficult to operationalize. So researchers have been working on this, and there is one theme that seems to be recurring, and that's the theme or the topic of capacity limits. So there is a bottleneck. The input to our perceptual system is far too rich for us to process all of the information that we are perceiving and subsequently encoding it into memory. But if we would be able to encode all that memory, we would also have the opposite problem, that the information encoded in our memories is far too extensive to be retrieved. We would not be able to retrieve everything at the same time. We would also have serious problems searching that huge memory store. So basically what researchers agree upon that attention is this selective focus on some aspects of your environment, whether it's internal or external. And then, of course, the next question arises, and that is, how does this selective focus come about? And again, there are at least half a dozen different theories as to how we would selectively focus our attention. And the one that linguists have adopted is the distinction between top-down versus bottom-up streams. So if you selectively focus on something and that focus is a top-down focus, you are activating contextually relevant elements, and you are guided by memory-dependent anticipatory mechanisms. So I will explain this to you with a simple example. So say, for example, you're going to the store, and you're going to a store that sells fruit. And when you're looking around in that store, you will fully expect there to be, for example, in the UK, I would fully expect there to be apples. So when I'm looking around in the store, I will not be surprised to see apples. Apples will not necessarily draw my attention. But when I'm looking at, for example, more closely at the green apples, and suddenly I see that among all of these green apples, there is a red one, then that red apple will attract my attention. So bottom-up is stimulus-driven focus that is memory-free and reactive. So you respond to something that you see, and that's kind of at odds with what you were expecting. Whereas when you go to the Apple store, and I won't be surprised to see apples, but if I told you that go to the store and find apples, you will definitely be able to ignore all of the other fruits and vegetables that are there and just focus on the apples. So those are the two, that's the main difference between bottom-up and top-down selective focus, so to speak. And you will recognize how this links back to the cognitive grammar notions of profiling a figure against the ground, and of course of construal, which is what we will be talking about in more detail in tomorrow's case study. So there has been some work on attentional processing and language, but it's surprisingly limited. And there seem to be two strands. One has to do with sentence organization, and the other one has to do with scene processing. So there is some work on sentence organization that suggests that the salient reference occupies salient sentence position. So for example, your agent in your scene will be the one that's doing the action, instigating something, carrying something out, initiating something. So that's the most important element in your event, so to speak. And it's been found that generally across a number of languages, these salient reference also occupy salient sentence positions. So your agent is more likely to be mentioned early on in the sentence than later on in the sentence. And that then has been taken as a support for the idea that language structure actually reflects human attentional mechanisms. So what grabs our attention, the one who is responsible for the action, that's also the one that in language will be encoded and in such a position that's the most important, the most prominent position. Another research direction has to do with a scene processing, and it's kind of a similar idea, and that is that elements that are put in salient sentence positions would attract also more attention. So the language structure directs human attention, and that is what our case study that we will be presenting tomorrow about construal in language is all about. So in previous research, researchers have looked mainly at the experience that you have and how attention is allocated to this. And what we were trying to do in the case study is moving more to from attention to memory. So of all of the things that we hear and attend to, what stands a chance of making it into memory? And that's something that I will answer tomorrow. So that's it for now. The second part came up a bit shorter, but it was difficult to stop earlier on in the talk. So we have a good half an hour for questions if you have any.